greater than you think.
It is later than you think, ladies and gentlemen, if you have turned in to the end of all history, which is our subject today. History, the end of history. Will there be an end of history? In order to understand that, we need to first understand what is history. Well, it's the story of mankind. And if it's the story of mankind, we need to understand what is man. And does man have a true nature? If so, then history has a direction. And if it has a direction, what is that direction? To what future are we progressing? And that question is a dangerous one. But there is an answer that two separate groups of people have arisen. But for now, turn your radio down. Step back. For the gods are approaching. That is an appropriate introduction, ladies and gentlemen. This is the W.M. Briggs Show, and our topic is the end of all history. So we need to understand what history is. And before we could do that, we first need to understand what it is that history is and what it is that man is. And so on this topic, let's hear from an eminent authority.
Yes, Libby.
If humanism were right in declaring that man is born only to be happy, he would not be born to die. Since his body is doomed to die, his task on earth evidently must be of a more spiritual nature. It cannot be unrestrained enjoyment of everyday life. It cannot be the search for the best ways to obtain material goods and then cheerfully get the most of them. It has to be the fulfillment of a permanent, earnest duty, so that one's life journey may become an experience of moral growth.
Now that was Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his famous, or rather infamous, speech he gave to the Harvard commencement address back in 1978. This was a shocking speech. It scared the hell out of the cultural Western elites who were present. How dare Solzhenitsyn mention truth, veritas, as if such a thing were real and objective? How could he implied that we were not marching forward brilliantly, but falling backwards into a kind of spiritual oblivion. Spiritual health more important than materialistic wealth? Madness. Well, as rich as this speech is, we take here only one element from it. The element that we played in the clip, that man is partly a spiritual being, proved by the fact that we die and that we understand what this means. Well, one day there was on this earth a creature that was not here the day before. Man. Everyone, from pagan to Christian to idolater, agrees with this. Man was different and is different than any other life form. Man, as opposed to the animals or the plants, is a rational being. Now, what it means to be rational is to exercise the will and the intellect. Now, the will and the intellect, those parts of us that have this power, are not material, which is to say they're not made of stuff, neither material nor energy. They are incorporeal, immaterial. And this means that evolution, by whatever physical mechanism it is said to work, could not have produced these powers. Why? Well, because there was no stuff upon which to make purchase, and therefore no environmental pressure could manipulate or create these higher functions. There's no physical or material or energy there, and so nothing upon which evolution could operate. Therefore, these higher functions had to come from somewhere else. And this is also proof, incidentally, that we are not a simulation inside some giant computer, which has implications we'll see later in the show. And a computer, of course, is necessarily physical. Even quantum objects, force fields, forces, laws, and so forth, particles, rather, are physical. Will and intellect exist? And this is proved by you right now, as your eyes will scan the blog later, or as your ears hear these words and you understand them, you apprehend them, you comprehend their meaning, and you seize, by which I mean you seize the concepts behind these words rationally. Now, since these powers exist, they are actual. And therefore, they must have been made actual by something. Something must have been their cause, but the cause could not have been physical. Well, the where from answer is obvious. They came from God. And I have a link to some proofs of this. I'm not going to prove it here. I'm going to take this as a given for the for this podcast. And I'm also going to explore what it means if it isn't true. In any case, I can't do more than just give you a broad hint about these things. So let's give broad hints about what it means to be rational.
This country has been attacked with nuclear weapons. We shall bring you further information as soon as possible. Meanwhile, stay tuned to this wavelength, stay calm, and stay in your own house. Remember, there's nothing to be gained by trying to get away.
There's nowhere to go. This is it, babies. That's point one. Point two is that physical stuff, the physical stuff that exists, had to come from somewhere. It could not have come from nothing. And nothing is defined as the complete and utter absence of anything. Therefore, the explanation for why there is any physical thing, which I mean by material or energy, has to have an explanation. And that explanation, we say, is also God. And this is another fact which has, of course, more consequences. Now, scientists take the material existence that surrounds us as a given. And biologists take the stuff of which we are made as a given. And both of these groups attempt, with greater and lesser success, to understand how this stuff works. These scientists, however, are powerless to explain the big question of why. They are forever silent, these scientists, on the nature, the essence of the non-material, which, as I said, comprises the most important parts of us and of the universe. Only philosophy and, of course, theology can answer these questions. Now, this being so, if we're to grasp where we came from and where we're going, we need to develop a philosophy or a theology of history. The science of history is taken care of by physicists and biologists. Scientists start with what is. They posit working rules and then guess what might happen. They're not always right, but at this point, it's incidental. Their confidence in their ability is never shaken by failure. Scientists have egos larger than actors. In any case, the theorems and predictions of science help on the peripheries of our philosophy of history, but they cannot provide everything we need. Well, what else do we have going for us to inform our new philosophy? Well, obviously, history itself. We have a long record of what has happened, more or less complete and more or less biased. Does it appear from this record that things just happen? That history is one damn thing after another? Or is there a direction to events? If there is a direction, why? And pointing to what? History cannot even be written without reference to a theory. And theories imply direction. If you want to write history, or even understand it, what time scale do you pick? What do you include? What events do you include? What events do you exclude? What scope? Local? Regional? Worldwide? Why these events and not those? And always in history, there is a contrast with the here and now, and with where the author of history expects mankind to go. And you could prove this to yourself. Don't take my word for it. You want to write about World War II. What is that exactly? When did it really start? Well, let's see. Stalin ruled Russia. How far back do you go in explaining Stalin? Marx? Well, would there have been a Marx? And in what sense does this question make sense? Without a Kant and Hegel? If not, how far back before Kant do we go? And so on and so on and so on. Editorial, which I mean theoretical, decisions when writing history or understanding history are inevitable. Removing anachronisms, i.e. theories, from the written historical record is all but impossible. And it should be now obvious that writing history logically implies that human nature exists. Otherwise, there'd be nothing to write and nobody to read, which means it must be understood properly, human nature, I mean, in order to write proper history. Well, it's propaganda of the so-called Enlightenment that only in the 17th century did we as a race realize that mankind could progress. Yet it was then that the word progress took on its modern connotation of something desirable or good. That we could progress toward an undesirable goal is now unthinkable. Did we not recently have a popular slogan, change we can believe in? Those touting it had no awareness that change in their hands could be negative. To progress is entirely positive.
BBC Radio 4. It's been announced that the world is about to end. There is nothing that we can do. The official advice from Her Majesty's government is to gather your loved ones around you and hug them. The end of the world means there will be a number of changes to the Radio 4 schedule. Tomorrow's Thought for the Day will be extended from 3 minutes to 3 hours. The panel on any questions is subject to change on account of their certain vaporisation, and a special edition of The Archers will bring radio's longest-running drama to a close. Brian and Jennifer sell Home Farm and are vaporised. Lillian and Paul run off together and are vaporised. The Grundys are trampled by a herd of bullocks and then vaporised. And Elizabeth has an unfortunate fall from the top of Lower Loxley. If you have any comments about Radio 4's End of the World programming, please write to Roger Bolton, Feedback, P.O. Box number 67234, London SE1P 4AX.
Boy, are those Britons pessimistic. Those were both, we heard, genuine clips from BBC Radio. The first clip was recorded to be used only in the case of emergency, and it was later leaked. Of course, the Britons have every right to be pessimistic and somewhat gloomy. Why? Well, look at their history. Their history. So we're right back at it. Why is their history important, and what role do Britons play in the course of human history? What role does their geography play? What role does the sea play? and on and on and on. What role, of course, does their race play? This is all important things. So this leads us to the natural question, what are the large threads that run through history? Now, there's no way we could summarize everything that happened in the next 15 minutes, but what's at least plain to everybody? Everybody can agree on what points? Well, let's see. At one point, there were very many fewer of us. Indeed, there was only one. And perforce located in only one spot. And now there are many of us and spread everywhere. That's progress in a positive sense if you cherish people. It's curious and important that this is not seen as progress by those who aren't so fond of people. Man was, when fewer in number, much more tribal than now, for obvious reasons of geology and technology, if nothing else. People never got along, but now we have acquired ways of killing ourselves with extraordinary efficiency. The beliefs we've held have changed. When there were fewer of us, I mean at any one time, so far there have been about 100 billion of us on the planet, but when there were fewer of us at any one time, a greater majority believed in the non-material aspects of ourselves and of the universe. These spiritual beliefs varied more, of course, but then we were, as I said, more tribal. Now that there are many of us, the belief in ultimate reality, immateriality, spirituality, is fading. This is strange because we have also, over the last 100 years or so, developed better and more efficient capabilities of learning. Now, despite these tools, we're becoming more ignorant. 6,000-7,000 years ago, a man would watch the course of the sun through the sky and suppose a god had carried it. We have, quote, progressed to the point where we scoff at this man, laugh at him, and say, now, only blind physics is needed to account for the movement. But this ancient man had it over on us, because he was at least aware, as today's man is not, that physics is no explanation at all for the why of the thing. The ancient man at least tried to answer that most important question of the spirituality of the thing. Modern man says the question isn't even legitimate. How strange that is. Here's another point of change. Long ago, man viewed mankind itself as a given. That is, he took men as he found them. He explained the reason for man and his nature and the course of events on the caprices of gods, whose designs were unfathomable and quixotic, to say the least. Now, the answers ancient man gave, good or bad, recognized the existence of a fixed human nature and were at least aimed in the right direction, the spiritual direction, to answer the final questions. Our ancestors knew there had to be ultimate spiritual answers. Now, the melancholy view of man's purpose was modified eventually by people of the book. We won't argue here for the proper requirements of these people, but you know who I mean. Now, these people, who, like the pagans, took human nature for granted. With pagans, book people recognized man's corrupt and unfixable state. The advance was that the book people understood God and not the gods was the answer to the big questions. More than any before, book people looked forward to the time after this physical existence and ordered their lives accordingly, though not, of course, given our faults altogether successfully. Finally, we reach the present, which is defined as that which happened yesterday. The present is always at some point undefined. How far back do we go to define the present? Last year? 10 years ago? 50? Well, see, again, we have to make decisions, and that implies theory, and that implies movement, and that implies directionality and some sort of goal. Now, today, a large portion of mankind, anyway, believe that perfection is possible, that, as said, directed progress, guided by the enlightened, is always good. That the answer to all questions ultimately is man himself. They call it being reason, or using their reason, and they call their findings reasonable. Perfection can be reached, and will, but only after all those that cling to the older beliefs are, to put it as bluntly as is felt in the hearts of modern man, eliminated. Those that can't be educated in the new way must be shunned. These living artifacts, they are cursed as medieval, are holding back man's true potential that bridles to be set free. If you're a modern, you see history as one steady uphill struggle, starting from the muck, slogging ever upwards through a moral thicket, shedding prejudice after prejudice. I'm just guessing, but I'd say most moderns imagine that they could see the peak just ahead. Perhaps not reachable in their lifetime, but soon. Soon. Moderns have a sense mankind is evolving into a superior being. This is most easily seen in science fiction. In science fiction, this being is always portrayed as an entity composed of, quote, pure energy, where that word pure has both of its meanings. If it's some kind of pure energy or the like. Energy is material, however, and we're not entirely material. Remember that. Now, this advanced being that the myth imagines is a creature that does not suffer our bodily woes and has advanced far beyond our cares and hates. Now, what makes this weird is that the modern, this perfectionist, if you like, when he watches or he reads these myths, feels he is taking part in a grand scheme that he himself will, and now, even now, shares in this future being's greatness. Interestingly, and this is worth thinking about, in these stories, what happens after the grand transformation is never spoken of. This isn't necessarily a failing. How can an imperfect man, which we all agree we are now, describe perfection except imperfectly? Now, beings of energy needn't be free form. Another form of the myth imagines, quote, we will be, quote, uploaded into some computer. And I wonder who fixes that when it breaks. Anyway, the same theme of bodily limitations in this myth is also found, because there are no bodily limitations when you're part of a computer. And the same notion of eternal life is embraced. Yet there is still an end built into this.
Reminder for our radio listeners that the end of the world is going to come next Tuesday at 4:30 p.m., and the Department of Health has requested homeowners to unplug all electrical appliances, turn off radios and TV sets, and disconnect gas stoves and furnaces. The post office recommends that you mail early in the day, and for those with automobiles, alternate side of the street parking will be suspended. That's the end of the world next Tuesday at 4:30 p.m. Mark it down.
I hope everybody put that in their calendars. It's very important. Let's see. If you're one of the remnant, I mean the people of the book, that believes, that still holds to the belief in reality. There are many people who claim to be members, of the book, but who are in fact perfectionists. But if you're still one of the older crowd who are a medieval, if you like, you see history differently than the perfectionist. You see history as a sort of large foothill, progressing from despair and hopelessness in pagan times to an intermediate pinnacle of recognizing our true selves, our true nature. And then, after this, comes a falling off into a deep valley of the grandest hubris that can be imagined. You see that not only can mankind not be perfected, but that all attempts to make him so will be destructive. and lead to an apocalypse. After the valley, book people say, history stops. It ends. It is no more. Yet beyond this valley is a far-off peak from which no descent will be possible. At the apex is found some of the same benefits perfectionists envision. Surcease of sorrow, elimination of bodily pain and illness, eternal life, and a realization of life with the central blot of man's nature removed. A new heaven and a new earth, populated not by new men, but by men restored. That's an important distinction. Men restored. Meaning, again, a recognition of a true spiritual nature. Now, all of these are very important things to keep grasped. You see, everybody has a philosophy and a theology of history. Theodicy and eschatology, end-of-the-world studies, are not only for the religious. Non-spiritual man also believes history has a direction. Nobody really believes, at least for very long, that events just happen. Both groups, perfectionists and realists, book people, look forward towards a great future. Now, isn't that amazing? The perfectionists would reach their goal by turning inward and ignoring reality, ultimate reality. And that, dear listener, is why they won't make it. Reality is intrusive and insistent. Incorporeal intellect, for instance, cannot be uploaded into a machine. How could it? Our blighted nature can only truly be corrected by forces beyond, or rather outside, man's control and outside materialist things. Perfectionists and realists envision an end. When? Timing? I haven't the slightest idea. Both sides have advocates who try and rush the end, and both groups are in turn overly optimistic and overly pessimistic. The goal is always said to be in sight. Predictions fail, but we never stop looking. And we won't. Stick around for next week, ladies and gentlemen, when it'll be time to polka.